like a lot of people say, how possibly do you run a company with three co-founders? That must be so complicated. And I ask, how could you possibly run a company with less than three? Any one of us is on some sine graph of energy and is having good days and bad days for all sorts of different reasons. And when you've got three people, someone's always in a pretty energetic state. And there are a lot of days when it is very powerful to look around and have someone reminding you why this crazy thing is worth doing. And that is worth a lot.
Hi, I'm Jubin, operating partner at Kleiner Perkins, and I'm excited that you're tuning into Grit. The goal of this is not for it to be a highlight reel of how successful my guests are, rather a candid exploration of how hard it is, both personally and professionally, to create, build, and scale world-class organizations. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe, leave a review, and make sure to follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter. Thanks. When I was getting ready to do this, I was going through our emails and just like the files of Watershed. It's been 3 years that we've been working together. First of all, like how cool is, like it's what so a cool. fun, what a fun thing to do together.
Totally.
And you don't know this, but folks internally know, like when we invested and you and I were starting to work together, I remember thinking, oh my God, should I quit my job and go to this company? That was like one of the first thoughts that I had. And the reason that I had that thought, I'm serious, I'm not blowing smoke. I only had this thought with one other company, is that when I looked, I think we first started working together because like I was helping you recruit maybe some people, something. Anyway, and I started going through the LinkedIn profiles of all the Watershed employees. This was Series A. So like pre-fancy John Doerr, Mike Moritz, board, Sequoia, all of Kleiner Perkins, like pre that, right? And I remember thinking, how did they get these people? They are outkicking their coverage in terms of the ability to attract people to this company. And it was very clear to me why, which was the mission of Watershed. But I just remember this, like, I don't know how to describe it, but I suspect you still feel this today, and maybe the pull is stronger, of this like gravitational force that this company has because of the mission of what it does, where people are joining just because they want to help solve this climate problem. And the money and the equity and the career, all of that comes through the form of solving the climate problem. But that's like 1A. And so, yeah, you've just always had incredible people. Anyway, that's my confession to you.
Well, maybe we should stop the tape and make this a recruiting conversation, Jubin, because we have just the role for you. But more seriously, it is the great joy of working on Watershed that the people on the team are absolutely phenomenal. And that was true with the first people who joined the team back in 2021. And it's true with the new hire class that joined on Tuesday, who are just spectacular. My first work experience was at Stripe after college. And one of the things that Patrick Collison said is that it's counterintuitively easier to build a hard company than an easy company. Because the harder what you're trying to pull off, the more ambitious, the steeper the climb, the more compelling that is to great people. And that actually makes it easier to build a really challenging, ambitious company than a company doing something less ambitious. And that's true. Like our mission is to accelerate the climate economy. We measure that in terms of the tons of CO2 reduced or removed every year. We want that to be 500 million tons of CO2 reduced or removed per year by 2030, which would be more than Germany, more than Australia, more than France. That is a terrifyingly ambitious thing to pull off. And I think it helps us attract truly awesome people. The one thing I'll say is that the day-to-day work of building Watershed is very much akin to the day-to-day work of building any software company.
Any like dirty, grimy software company.
Totally.
Like if you were building an ERP system or something, it still feels really hard.
Totally. Every day you are writing code, you are calling on customers, yeah. You're hiring people, you're having tough conversations as a manager. And so Monday to Friday, like you are doing the day-to-day work of building a software company. And I think that means that we've tried to build a team of people who love that craft and love doing that every day. And then there's this amazing joy on Friday night when you kind of finish the work of the week, look back on what you accomplished. Maybe you're a little worn down because things didn't really go your way that week. And you've got this extra energy boost that comes from knowing that this is not just any software company. If we do this right, it could really matter for a problem that really matters. And I think that combination is the special joy of working on
this. Okay, but your CRO, who we both know obviously very well, is one of the best in our portfolio. And he came inbound. Did he not?
Dan sent me, Dan Miller-Smith, who leads our sales and revenue teams, sent me a LinkedIn message in fall of 2021. I have never responded to a LinkedIn message ever before. And he sent me a LinkedIn message saying we should talk.
Because of the mission. It just resonated with him. And I suspect that that's the case for many people. Just thinking about it now, does it make it harder to sift through some people because they're so passionate about the mission? But you have to be at the intersection of competence and passion for the mission. And I would imagine that this has been your life's work. So you probably really resonate with people that also feel that way.
Yeah.
Does it give you the like climate goggles a little bit? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think that's where it comes down to. There's this really magical alignment between building a really powerful software company and having a big climate impact.
Yeah.
You know, when we're hiring for an AE, when we're hiring for an engineer, that craft really matters because yeah. that is the path to 500 megatons of CO2 not in the atmosphere every year.
Yeah. Well, where the business is today is certainly not where it was when we first started working together. And you strip away all of the good for humanity pieces of this business, and it's just an epic business. Like it is amazing. Do you want to share, like, I don't know, give the primer on like, how does a company use Watershed?
So Watershed is on a mission to solve climate change. Our product is a enterprise sustainability platform, and we've built the world's first true enterprise software for sustainability and climate data. And that means that companies can use Watershed to measure their carbon emissions, basically x-ray their business, x-ray their supply chain, reach into the stuff they're buying from vendors, think about all of their operations, business travel, the whole thing, measure the carbon emissions of the company. That's step one. Step two is to report on that. Basically, sustainability data is becoming like financial data for large companies. And so if you're a CFO, you are thinking about the fact that next year in Europe, you are reporting on your carbon emissions and a whole bunch of other sustainability indicators in your annual report for the first time. So that's kind of part two, is this investor grade, regulator grade reporting. And then the thing that gets us really energized is that companies use Watershed to operationalize sustainability, operationalize carbon reductions across the business. It means that we've got companies redesigning travel policy, their supply chain policies, what materials are they buying from suppliers, buying clean power, and kind of tracking all of that in Watershed. So if we do this right, Watershed becomes for sustainability what Salesforce is for sales teams, what Oracle is for finance teams, this kind of core software platform for a really important part of the business. And that's what we sell every day. That's what we build every day. That's what we sell every day. That is the day-to-day work of the company.
I'm in LA.
Yeah.
And I am having lunch with Jonathan Neiman, the CEO and founder of Sweetgreen. Yeah. And we start just rapping, and he's like, you know, what companies are hot in the KP portfolio? And one of the first out of my mouth was Watershed. And I didn't know that Sweetgreen was customer number one of Watershed.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I know Watershed. And he was almost bitter, because he's like, yeah, I wanted to like put a bunch of money into this company, and like you and everybody else like boxed us out. There was no space on the cap table. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. He's like, yeah, we love it. And I'm like, that's what you want your first customers to say. That's how you want your first customers to feel.
Sweetgreen has a very special place in the story of the company. So we got started in fall of 2020, and we sat down in my co-founder Christian's guest bedroom in San Francisco and started thinking about what we wanted to build. That was maybe in October. And we can talk more about kind of how we decided to work on this, but very quickly we decided that the test of whether this was a good idea is if we could get any company to pay us for it. And so we hit the street. You know, I went across the Bay to Oakland after that first week on the first Friday, and there was a sustainability conference happening at the Hilton in Oakland. And so I bought the $50 ticket that got you invited to the lobby and the party and not the actual keynote, and just started talking to people and telling them that we had this climate software that helped you measure and report your carbon emissions. And the company, that idea was a day old, and we were out kind of in the field talking to folks. And so I remember that the day before Christmas Eve of that year, December 23rd, 2020, maybe a couple of days before, we got an email from the head of supply chain at Sweetgreen. And we'd been pitching him for a couple months, but kind of hadn't heard from him in a couple of weeks. And he said, you know, we're actually, this is picking up some momentum. Would you be up for coming down to Sweetgreen on December 23rd in LA to kind of have a final demo? And I, of course, wrote back and say, as a matter of fact, I was already planning to be in LA. And Christian and Avi and I stayed up the whole night before getting the demo ready and the deck ready. And they were the first enterprise that said yes to us. And that is a transformational moment when you've got this validation from a customer that it's going to solve a problem. And they've been an awesome partner to this day.
It's pretty incredible. You miss those days? Or are you happy to be at this point now? Honestly.
It's been really fun. Every chapter of it has been really fun. I write every night in a daily journal where you write a few lines of what you did that day, and then it shows you what you did that day the year before, that day the year before, that day the year before.
Is it digital?
No, no, it's in a paper journal. Okay. And so I can see what I was doing on any given day going back 5 years, and kind of all of Watershed, I've been doing this journaling habit. Someone gave me this journal right as I was about to leave Stripe. And so it is kind of fun to look at a given day and say, okay.
It's organized by day of the month annually.
Yeah, totally. And so I can look back and anyway, it's fun to see on certain days, like, you know, I spent the entire day working on spreadsheets for Sweetgreen. You know, that was the product at the time had a human behind it. And yeah, we've come a long way. It's kind of fun to look back at the journey.
When you reflect on those days, I guarantee you the days where you're working on spreadsheets for a customer probably didn't at the time feel that energizing. Maybe it did, but like it's hard work to your point. Like you strip away all the goodness of the company, it's still hard work. When you look back, when you think to a day 4 years ago to this day, 3 years ago, whatever, and it was a tough day, are you going to look back in that day and be like, oh yeah, I remember that was a tough day? Or do you kind of just like gloss over, do you build a narrative of the company that was like, yeah, it was so fun? Probably most of those days, the lived reality was it was fucking hard, right?
I do think organizations fall victim to a golden age syndrome. And there's a whole thing that happens at companies where everyone always kind of looks back to the good old days. And the good old days were generally not good. The good old days were before you had systems. The good old days were before you had support and all the supporting functions. The good old days were when the product broke in all sorts of ways that you take for granted today. So yeah, people completely gloss over that. And it's really powerful today to have a team of a few hundred people, to have all of this infrastructure and capability and capacity that we didn't have then. I think the other thing that, as I reflect as kind of a founder journey, the first year and a half were such an emotional roller coaster where you have an experience. Like I remember in that first year before COVID, I was spending every day going around San Francisco on BART, on the Lyft e-bikes, talking to prospective customers. And you'd have a meeting where, you know, the customer doesn't really give you the time of day. There's no budget. And you walk out of that meeting thinking, what are we doing? Like, we're completely lying to ourselves. No one is ever going to spend money on sustainability. This is never going to be something you can capture in software. You kind of just feel like it's all going to be for nothing. And then you go into another meeting and it's Sweetgreen and they've got a problem that's exactly the way you've been thinking about it, or it's a customer where you've got a case study that speaks exactly to what they need, and they walk out really energized and you walk out like you are on top of the world. And that's in like 4 hours. And so the founder experience is this incredible emotional roller coaster on the question of, are we on to something? And it's really challenging to be on that internal roller coaster on, are we on to something? And so as I look back, that's the thing that was kind of the most challenging about those early days was, yeah, you've got the hard work and the sweat and the long hours. That's all manageable. But the journey of, are we onto something, is something that is exhausting.
Do you think that your emotional band has narrowed the further away you've gotten from existential death? Or do you think you still feel the ups and downs in the same way that you used to?
I think there's a coping mechanism to narrow the emotional band, for sure. And the, you know, and the reality for Watershed is if you're kind of building up the Jenga tower of that turns into a real edifice of a company. It starts as a Jenga tower and you want it to turn into something that can endure for many decades. The foundation layer of that building is a really powerful foundation of certainty and conviction that now enables us to solve all sorts of other more complicated problems, but on this bedrock of, hey, this mission, this product, like there is something really big here. If only we can be the one to figure out how to build it right.
Yeah. You're seemingly on the right path. Today, is truly the most valuable climate software company in the world? Does this just sound weird to hear?
I think that's a statement about the fact we need a lot more climate companies.
that's probably true. You have raised 240-ish million to date. John Doerr, Mike Moritz co-led A and B together from Kleiner and Sequoia. And first time they've done a deal together since Google. When you like pitch people, are you kind of like, oh God, like this is like kind of like a weird flex, you know, like, do you feel like maybe I should flex?
I think this? It just means the expectations are very high.
Al Gore is now on the cap table. We were having a CEO summit last week in Napa. And I was walking by you. I was terrified to interrupt, but it was you sandwiched between Al and John. And I was like, man, what could they possibly be talking about? But it's probably like two older brothers beaming with pride of just like what's happening and what you're doing to help fight what they've been fighting for like basically their entire life. Really cool, right? That was like, just must be really cool.
And that is, I mean, Al Gore is the reason I'm working on this. As you know, when I was 13, I saw An Inconvenient Truth, went to the movie theater with my mom in San Mateo, and walked out of the movie theater just totally angry, fired up, some weird mix of like pissed off and energized. And it felt like this kind of generational call to arms that my parents had screwed our generation by causing this problem. We as kids were gonna feel the brunt of it. You're 13, I was 13 at the time, it was 2006, and have some sort of naive sense that you can do something about it if only you stand up. And I ended up participating in this training that Al Gore started that is, I don't know, there was a USA Today article this week. I think they've trained something like 50,000 people. That number may be an exaggeration. It's an astonishing number of people that the Climate Reality Project has trained to give the Inconvenient Truth slideshow, to be the cavalry in their communities. Uh-huh. And I was part of the first training of a couple hundred people in Nashville, Tennessee. And my mom had to come get me a hotel room because I was 13 years old. And that was the beginning for me of this whole climate mission of feeling like this was the thing to work on. So, you know, there's a few people who totally change your life. And for me, Al Gore is one of those people. And I think broadly for the climate movement, we would not be where we are, which is we've got a slim chance of solving climate change. Just the teeny tiny slim chance of solving climate change. And the only reason we've got that shot is because he raised the alarm back in 2006. So yeah, it's amazing to have him be a part of Watershed.
Were you literally going around giving the pitch?
It wasn't in PowerPoint, it was in Keynote because Al Gore is the longest serving Apple board member. They sent us away with a binder with recycled cardboard as the outside of the binder. And inside the binder, every page was one of the slides. And has a whole page describing the science of the slide and the narrative and different ways to frame it. And then they sent us off into the world to go give the Inconvenient Truth talk. And so my beat was doing Inconvenient Truth at high schools, mostly in California, but I ended up going to China and doing a speaking tour in Beijing and Shanghai.
No way.
Because my big realization was that all the other presenters, the big challenge was marketing. How do you get people to show up to your event? It's kind of hard to get someone to come to a library to hear a neighbor give a version of the documentary you've already watched.
Who's like 15 years old.
And I was like, well, okay, I'm just going to have mandatory audiences, mandatory assemblies at schools. And so I solved the marketing problem. It was a channel partnership. You do the channel partnership with the schools, you get the audience there. And so I would give this assembly to Bay Area high schools and middle schools on, yeah, what this was going to mean for us. And there was a take home that said, go home to your parents and tell them to switch the light bulbs and to vote for candidates who care about climate. And I was trying to mobilize a bunch of kids to get their parents to do something.
That's crazy. How long did you do that for?
I did it for all of high school.
No kidding.
Yeah, I skipped a lot of class.
And then were you convinced at this point you're going to start a climate company?
No. I wanted to work on policy. I felt like the vector for climate was public policy. Went to college, studied public policy. I don't know, in sophomore year, the cap and trade bill, which was President Obama's kind of signature legislation to solve climate change by creating this market mechanism to put a price on carbon, failed in Congress. And coming out of college in the aftermath of that, I didn't know what to work on that could matter on climate. Because I wasn't a scientist. I felt like I couldn't add anything to figuring out how to make solar cells more efficient or how to solve long duration energy storage or these like epic scientific grand challenges. It felt like there was kind of a pause in the policy environment because of the failure of this cap and trade bill. And so I actually kind of was in a bit of a moment coming out of college of not knowing what to work on, because all of my life had been going in the direction of working on climate change. And I couldn't quite figure out the thing that felt like it would be impactful. And I was from San Francisco or from the Bay Area, and so kind of knew about tech and startups, and ended up at Stripe because I thought every person I interviewed with at Stripe was just the smartest, kindest person I'd ever met. And if you could work with a whole company of those, that would be a blast. Mm. And then, yeah, that was what kind of started down the tech path. And then Watershed was really a merging of that moment of watching An Inconvenient Truth as a 13-year-old and then seeing that tech companies can be pretty effective ways to make things happen in the world.
When you were at Stripe, amazing company. At some point where you're like, okay, like Stripe in 2014 was like an infant company relative to what it was today, but you could feel the gravity of that
company.
Total
magic.
Right? Like, you're right. All the people there are like game changers. You spent, what, 5 years there? After a few 4 years, are you not like, okay, I could build like a huge career here. You are doing really well. Your co-founders were at Stripe. They were doing really well. The company was growing, probably still is, like one of the canonical companies in tech. Anyway, at some point were you not like, I'll keep riding this out. Maybe I'll make a bunch of money. Maybe I'll build a huge career. And then I'll go back to like solving the climate problem.
Stripe was awesome and remains awesome. And they were one of our first customers. And Patrick and John are investors. And the magic of Stripe to me was this realization that the more ambitious the company, it gives you all sorts of extra energy, and that if you just have an exceptionally high bar for talent, it's possible to build an organization that just has astonishingly good people who will then spend the rest of their lives working together. But the realization for us in 2020 was that we were starting this critical decade of climate, and that we wanted to be spending our days, day in and day out, working on that. And that became the organizing principle for Avi, Christian, and I, is how do we spend the next decade working on this climate problem? And it might be through a startup, but we also thought about a whole bunch of other ideas too. About,
like what?
When we sat down in September of 2020, the task we'd set ourselves was work on something that would add up to 500 megatons a year of carbon reduction per year. That was the only constraint. And we gave ourselves 10 days, kind of 2 weeks, to workshop different ideas. We workshopped one idea every day. And at the end of those 2 weeks, we wanted to pick the one that felt like it was most likely to have impact and work on that.
And you were sure at this point the three of you wanted to work together?
Yes. We'd met at Stripe. We did all these backpacking trips on the weekend and had kind of worked on different projects together. And I think from that, I at least knew that I would want to do anything I could to work with Avi and Christian. And if that was working for them at some other company, if that was working for them at some startup that they started, if it was working with them on a startup, even better. But like, principle number one, find a way to work with Avi and Christian, because those are the two best people I'd ever come across in my life. Principle number two, work on climate. And so there we are in September, and we've got principle number one. The three of us are in a room with a whiteboard that we bought on Amazon the night before, and put up on the whiteboard this 500 megaton goal. And the ideas we workshopped were, let's see, we thought about what's a political campaign that we could lead that would have impact on climate policy. We thought about what's a kind of consumer app on climate, like what's the Strava for climate that gets people thinking about their day-to-day habits. We thought about what's a science research foundation that somehow attracts exceptional talent to work on the climate problem in a way that if you get the organizational structure right, I think OpenAI at the time had proved like, hey, if you get the organizational, well, a very storied organizational structure as it's transpired, but it was an amazing talent density of people working on AI. Could we do something like that on some of the hard science problems around climate? So we workshopped all these different ideas. And the second one we talked about was what at the time we called B2B decarbonization. B2B decarb, that was the idea in the Notion doc. And that was this observation that companies do all the emissions. Companies are blind to where the carbon in their organizations come from. They're going to be under pressure from regulators and investors. Let's build software that turns that potential energy of disclosure pressure into the kinetic energy of decarbonization. And that was the one where when we did the math on the whiteboard, that was the fastest way to count to 500 megatons a year of CO2 reduced. And so that was the thing we decided to work on.
And how long from that point to Sweetgreen?
So that was in September. Our first kind of beta customer went live the Monday after Thanksgiving. So that's like maybe two months later. And then Sweetgreen, which is, you know,
A month after that. That's,
we got to work fast.
And it was just the three of you, or did you already recruit people?
No, it's just the three of us. Our approach
had
was,
you quit already?
We quit. We're working full time on Watershed. And the theory was just that no idea was good until a customer had put money behind it.
And did you tell the Collisons what you were working on?
Christian at Stripe had helped to start Stripe's climate program. And so Christian led huge swaths of Stripe's engineering team and somehow found the time on the side to start this pioneering climate commitment that Stripe launched, which was to commit at the time $1 million towards permanent carbon removal. And that has grown to a nearly $1 billion purchasing commitment from Stripe and Microsoft and Alphabet and a whole bunch of other companies and Watershed now as a partner. And so Christian kind of helped to start the Stripe climate program that set a bar at the time for how companies could do work on climate that was really impactful. And so he'd had all these conversations with other companies that called him and said, hey, tell us more about that approach you're taking. And so I think Stripe was a big part of realizing that companies could do work on climate, but that the status quo of how they were doing that was totally broken. And we wanted to kind of build the tools that Christian wished he had had when he was starting the Stripe climate program.
That makes sense. So you leave, tell the Collisons, like, we're leaving, we're going to go work on this thing. Stay tuned, basically. And you haven't raised any money yet. You take 3 months, you have a customer. And then how long from then till Series A?
I actually don't exactly remember. I think it was...
It was February of 21.
Was when
Does
we
that seem right?
We announced it in February of 2021. I think it was at some point in 2020. So we just kept chugging along.
Like, you took time before you raised money.
Yeah, I mean, we had customers paying us. And they were
multiple.
Just, we had multiple customers paying us. And... yeah, there's nothing quite as magical as a sales deal getting closed. That was the oxygen. It remains the oxygen, but especially in that first year, that was the oxygen of the business.
Those first 10 deals are, there is no better fit.
There is, I mean, sales is still my favorite part of the job. And so I still get that thrill of being a part of deals. But I think back to every move, every mistake, every setback, every negotiation on the early customers. And that was the magic of getting started.
But it's interesting because so many entrepreneurs are as eager as possible to go raise money as soon as possible. And in a lot of cases, it feels like they actually don't have much leverage. Like, they're not in a strong position relative to what it seems like you all were in. Like, nothing like paying customers.
Nothing like paying customers.
To get VCs excited about a company.
And to confirm for yourself that you're onto something.
Totally.
When you're on that emotional roller coaster of every day, am I tricking myself or is this going to be huge? the fact that a customer is parting with money to help buy your thing, to have them solve a business problem, is the surest way to feel like, okay, there's something here. We're headed in the right direction.
And at what point were you like looking around at your co-founders being like, I think we can get John Doerr and Mike Moritz on the board? I actually don't know the backstory. And as much as you feel comfortable sharing,
I mean, we were extremely fortunate for this to be the case.
Because what a good marketing thing.
Well, I think more importantly, what an amazing company building thing. I feel insanely lucky to have built the company with the guidance of spectacular board members. Christian knew Michael from Stripe. Michael, of course, had been on the board at Stripe. And I knew John because John was in that first cohort of Climate Reality Project presenters. And he organized, and I mean, John Doerr is extraordinary in so many ways, but he had organized a dinner for all the Bay Area presenters. And so that was how I met John. And our Series A actually was not trying to have some sort of blockbuster set of names. It was just trying to build the company with the investors that we knew the best and that we had had the most enduring relationships with. And that was the origin of actually, I think that's been the principle of every investor, every partner, as we've built the company, just who are people that we think we can learn from, who we know well, that are going to be steady partners in doing what is going to be a very hard thing over many, many years.
How did you and your co-founders decide on the split of titles or roles and responsibilities?
So there's three of us, and I'll say that the great joy of this thing is working with Avi and Christian every day. We, in about the first month, kind of sat down and said, what are some principles on how we want to work together? And we wrote it all down. So we've got an artifact. And the three things we really cared about were we wanted to run the company together. And we actually had the statement that we wanted each of us to be interchangeable with the other for any kind of strategic decision. And that's a hard thing to pull off because it means you need to have shared context and shared ownership. But when you get there, it really means you're kind of carrying the weight of the company together. So that we wanted to kind of run the company together. We wanted to have a DRI culture where decisions are not made by consensus. They're made by single people who have responsibility for the outcome, are close to the details, close to the customers, close to the code, close to whatever the core nub of the thing is. And we wanted to be a non-hierarchical place. So we wanted to be a place that didn't put a premium on titles, because if you have too much of a premium on titles, that kind of comes at the cost of collaboration.
Which is very Stripey, by the way.
Yeah, it's something we learned at Stripe. It comes, you don't want to be in a mode where people are looking around the table and having the person with the fancy title making the decision. You want the DRI to make the decision. You want the person who's closest to the work to make the decision. So those were these principles we had on how we wanted to run the company over many years.
Can I dig into those three principle things?
Yeah.
On the first one, which is running the company together, how have you learned to gain shared context? Is it like Slack channels?
I think...
because that's annoying.
I think that the big thing we all share is this obsession with trying to get to the ground truth. You know, and it's not a particularly low carbon metaphor, but trying to get to the coal face of any piece of work. And so... that was very easy at the beginning when Christian and Avi were writing all the code and I was doing every single customer. Well, we were all doing every customer interaction, all of us were CC'd on. It takes work as the company.
You were all CC'd.
Yeah, we were the account team, you know? it was really helpful to have a three-person account team. You've got a CSM, you've got an AE, you've got a kind of technical specialist. We needed full court press on those early customers. It takes work when you're a company of 300 people, and it's easy as leaders to consume the summary of the summary of the summary. And so I think we are all obsessed with get to the coalface, which is, in general, is the customer conversation or the customer interaction with the product. And I think if we have a shared sense of how are different customers in different categories succeeding or not succeeding, giving feedback, complaining, enthusiastically upselling for or not different surfaces of the product, I think that's the most important context for us to share. And the thing on working together, like a lot of people say, how possibly do you run a company with three co-founders? That must be so complicated. And I ask, how could you possibly run a company with less than three? Any one of us is on some sine graph of energy and is having good days and bad days for all sorts of different reasons. And when you've got three people, someone's always in a pretty energetic state. And there are a lot of days when it is very powerful to look around and have someone reminding you why this crazy thing is worth doing. And that is worth a lot.
Yeah. I guess the narrowing of the emotional band can only go so far. You're at the 300 person mark-ish.
Actually, just this week.
Congrats. Holy shit. Where were you at last time this year?
I think we were probably about 200 people this time last year.
And then what about the year before that?
Probably about 50 people.
Wow. And I can't remember the name, but there's a name for when you cross 130 or 20. I'm sure you know the name. What's the name?
The Dunbar number.
The Dunbar number, yeah. It's a fancy way of saying that basically you forget people's names. You don't know everybody's name in the company anymore. You've passed that. You've blown by that. Is that odd? Oh, shit. Like, we're becoming a big company. Big, relatively speaking.
Yeah, I think that it changes the work you have to do, for sure. Our first office was three blocks away from here on Freelon Street, and we rented it actually in the middle of COVID. And during COVID, we said, one person can work from the office a day. And it was kind of a perk. You can escape, you know, your work from home, being in the same room as your partner, and alternate who can work from this office every day. And then once folks got vaccinated, we had people in that office. And I look back on that with a lot of fondness because we had lunch around the picnic table outside and the whole company fit around the picnic table. And so you don't have to do a lot of internal comms work at that stage.
Right.
Osmosis is a very powerful tool for internal comms.
Right.
And when you pass the Dunbar number, I think it means that as leaders, there's now a whole new category of work, which is, how do you get everyone the shared context, right? If Christian, Abby, and I want to have the shared context where we can run the company together, that kind of extends to the whole company. You want everyone to have the shared context of customer needs, business context, engineering priorities, constraints. And it happens automatically when you're all around one table. It takes a lot of work as you start to grow. An entrepreneur who I really admire gave me advice when we were just getting started. And he said that culture begins when there's a closed door. The second there's a meeting where not everyone's in that meeting, that's where you need to really invest in culture, because culture is what fills the gap. Culture is what tells people, I know what's going to happen in that meeting because notes are going to be shared, because we've got a culture of transparency, of shared ownership. And in bad cultures, that's a moment where people start to think about their own position rather than what's best for the company. And so, yes, there's a big threshold that happens once you cross Dunbar's number. But I was really struck by that thought, that culture actually starts much earlier. And the kind of organizational norms that lead people to build a really high-performing organization actually starts
at that picnic table.
At the picnic table, yeah.
Knowing what you know now at 300 people, do you wish you did even more intentionally or differently around the metaphorical picnic tables?
I'm glad that we were intentional about writing down our operating principles, which we did in Golden Gate Park with four people when it was in the middle of COVID and we were in a social distancing 10 feet away from each other vibe, but brought our laptops into Golden Gate Park and wrote a doc of what are the principles that we want to be true about how we work. And we've kind of evolved those. Initially, we evolved them every time a new person joined, and that didn't really scale. And so we evolved them every year now at the all-company offsite. I'm really glad that we kind of created that tradition before the picnic table in a kind of COVID-era outdoor picnic environment. I wish that we had invested more in the mechanics of internal comms, in the maintenance of Notion docs and Slack norms. And there are many things broken with Watershed. One of the things that is broken is that we've got a bit of information sprawl at the company. And I think that's a thing where we're now investing a lot to try to correct. But I wish we'd had the realization that there was a real job there in shaping the way the river was going to flow on documents and contacts and communication channels, because that matters on getting everyone on the same page.
And are those operating principles independent from the principles that you and the two co-founders laid out?
I think that was V0 of the operating principles.
Okay.
And V1 was actually very, you know, V0 was maybe three principles. V1 was a very long list around the type of company we wanted to be. And now we've got kind of five principles that are they're both anthropological and they're aspirational, right? They're anthropological in describing how we've done our best work, and they're aspirational in the way we want to change the company to do even better work.
Give me an example.
Tomorrow. The two principles that have been evergreen since the first iteration are customer obsession, be customer obsessed. And I think that speaks for itself. It's the first one for a reason. It speaks to companies only have a license to do something that matters in the world if their customers being delighted every day. And that goes back to Sweetgreen, and it continues to the last customer we signed yesterday. The other one that's been evergreen since the beginning, it's taken different formulations, is trying to build a company at the intersection of intensity and care. And this notion that we want to be a company filled with people who are intense, who are outcomes driven, who are gritty, who are persistent, resilient, competitive, accountable. You're trying to do something really special in the world, but we don't want to be a company of intense jerks. We want to be a company of people who are intense, but also have deep empathy, deep integrity, deep kindness, care for the people that they work with. I think that is a magical Venn diagram. And I think there are many companies that are intense but not caring. I think there are many companies that are caring but not intense. Our aspiration, and on our best day it's true, and it's our aspiration for this to be even more true, is to be at that intersection of intensity and care. And I think that's where really special work can get done.
If I was interviewing at Watershed, and maybe in an alternate universe I would be, how would you test for intensity? Do you? I imagine you do. I imagine you're interviewing for it.
Honestly, we share a version of our operating principles with every candidate. When any candidate asks me, you know, what I care about in the company, I give some version of the spiel I just gave. And I think that self-selection does a lot of work. I think there are some people who hear that and say, intensity is not for me. I think there are some people who hear that and hear about some of our norms around sharing your personal priorities with your team and really trying to bring your whole self to work and say, you know, that environment's not for me. And so as a result, I think we've ended up with a team of people that are in this special Venn diagram you don't find every day. But when you find it in every single colleague, that's pretty magical.
Yeah, I think that's well said. What are the norms? What are some of the norms that you just touched on?
Another really kind of ritual that goes back to actually day one of the company, before we got out on the whiteboard, is that Christian and Abby and I sat down and said, what are our personal priorities? What are the things that are going on in our lives? What's the landscape of our life outside of work? Because we're about to do a crazy thing, and that's going to take up a lot of slots on the personal priority list. And it's really important for us to share with each other what else really matters. What do we want to hold fast to? And we did kind of each took some time to write down, hey, here are my personal priorities, talk through them one at a time. And that was the very first hour of the company. And we continue that today with when new folks join their team, they have a conversation with their team around, hey, here's what matters to me. Here's what is more important to me than work. And people share what they're comfortable with, but it leads to this kind of special trust, that this dynamic of people kind of watching out for each other, knowing what you're trying to solve for outside of the office. And I think that's been a big part of how we try to cultivate the care part of intensity and care.
Let's just assume there's categories of things that matter outside of work. Do you have to drop some? Do you fully abandon them? Let's just say it's friends or family or physical health, or you know, like name your thing. There's a bunch of different categories. How did life change? And were you intentional or not about deciding what those categories look like once Watershed ate up 70% of all time or whatever?
The thing is just to be intentional about what you want to hold fast to. And that was kind of the purpose of the exercise at the very beginning, was to say, hey, what are the things that are more important than work that we're not willing to drop each of us individually. And it might be a relationship, it might be health, it might be family. And you generally don't have capacity to be great at everything. And so rather than be mediocre at everything, be intentional about what are the things you want to really hold on to. I feel like this has been a really kind of rich 5 years in the full life picture for all of us. And I think having some honesty and some transparency and some accountability has been a part of that.
What have you had to give up? What's the thing that you're definitely sure you have done much less of?
I don't know. I think it's easy to get into a narrative. This is me trying to not answer the question, but I think it's easy to get into a narrative.
You're filibustering me.
I think it's easy to get into a narrative around founder life is so hard.
Yeah.
Woe is me. I don't buy that. I feel so lucky. This is an insanely great job. And let me leave it at that. I think that this has been a total joy, not just because the work is super interesting, but because it leads to a really full and robust and creative life.
Yeah.
And so I don't buy the whole founder woe is me narrative.
Yeah, it's almost like sometimes I get overwhelmed in work or whatever, but most of the work is the work I'm choosing to go do. Like I'm opting in every day for this work. And I could do other work. I could not work and figure something else out. Like I could lower my burn and do something different. Whereas some of the other things, like family, let's just say, opting out of that is a very different type of thing. You can't opt out of it in the same way. And it's not hitting you every day with things in the same way that work might be. And so sometimes I agree with you when I get like overwhelmed with work. I'm like, hey, asshole, this ambitious project that you wanted to like go take on, that's now like, I've shaved my head now, but losing your hair, you chose to take that in, like, that's you doing this. You know what I mean? That's you choosing to go do this thing. Anyway.
Did this podcast cost you your hair, Jimmy?
I mean, the podcast would be a great example of like, I feel pressure to perform. I want to be present and engaged, and I want it to be great for my guests and for the audience. And sometimes that pressure to perform weighs on me when I have prep late at night or whatever, right? But then I'm like, what am I talking? Like, I could cancel. I could stop the show. There's like so many ways for me to like stop doing this thing. You know what I mean? Does that tension make sense?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my relation to it. You have said that one thing that you wish that we, Watershed, has done differently, or all the things that you wish Watershed had done differently, are about moving faster. Mm. Can you explain that? Well, is that true?
Yeah. I think it was Mike Moritz who said when we were just getting started that a good board will, when you have a tough time, kind of energize you. And when you're at the top of your game, knock you down a couple pegs. And so I remember in, I don't know when it was, I don't know, maybe our fourth or fifth board meeting, we came to the board with an epic quarter. And we were selling customers left and right. We crushed our end of year revenue goal by June. We were feeling great. And John and Michael said, folks, it seems like you're under executing in a pretty big way. I'm like, what? Did you see these numbers? You see these results we just turned in? He said, this tells us that you are not moving fast enough to capture this opportunity. How many salespeople do you have? We have only one. We were so proud. One salesperson turning in these amazing revenue numbers. He said, well, that's a huge mistake, because if there's this much demand in the market, you should have a team of five and you should be building the engine that can support them and the management and the enablement and the content that enables sales to be a team sport. And you're nowhere on that. And hey, we've got these European customers, even though we don't have anyone in Europe. Well, that's a mistake. You should be building a European operation that's going to be on the front edge of where the future of this market is. So that was kind of the first board meeting where we got knocked around a bit. And it was after turning in the best results of the company to date. And I think what they were saying is that once you know you're onto something, which is the big existential dread and question mark that hangs over every company early on, but once you know you're onto something, speed and agility are everything. And we at that time, I think, were being a little too precious and moving a bit too slowly about capturing what is sort of a unusual once in a generation market where every company has to start doing something all at once. And there was an extra gear we needed to go find.
But what was, I mean, there was an explanation for that at the time. Like, what was the rationale of why you were proud to have customers in Europe without a presence there? Or there must have been a reason why you felt that way.
Well, we were doing a lot with very few people.
You're out kicking your coverage.
And what they said is, no, your market's doing a lot and you're not executing at the scale and speed that the market demands. And that was an epic wake-up call. I think about that a lot.
The market's doing more now than it ever has. The recent SEC ruling around filing on carbon emissions, BlackRock and State Street putting pressure on all their portfolio companies. Putting pressure is putting it lightly. They're mandating the data. Europe has been on the forefront of this stuff. The European version of the SEC has been doing this for a while now, right? So like now you see all these things. Are you like elated but also terrified of not taking advantage of what is becoming a bigger market opportunity than any of us could have imagined? Maybe you, John, and Al were prescient, which I think you were, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, we're at a moment where because of regulation, because of customers, and because of investors, every large company in the US and Europe, sustainability and climate are part of doing business now. And that is tens of thousands of large enterprises that are making sustainability reporting an obligation of their controller and their finance teams, integrating this into procurement, into every decision. And I think we're just in the very early innings of what that broad imperative, kind of making climate and sustainability a business imperative for every company, looks like. And yeah, I think you captured the emotional state correctly. It is really energizing to be working on this when there's a market moment, especially you think about people like Al Gore who've been working on climate for 50 years. And I think it's something where it happens very slowly and then all at once. And we're in the and then all at once phase of the climate economy getting deployed. So that's pretty exciting. When you're an organization trying to build the software platform to power that wave, and it's the biggest economic wave the world has seen since the internet, it's also a little intimidating. And yeah, we've got our work cut out for us in a big way.
Can I explore the tension of moving fast a little bit more?
Because totally.
I think it's easy to say move fast.
Yep.
But I remember even in the earliest days of Watershed, one of the inhibitors for us to move fast was a data problem, meaning you have to go through each vertical, right? Maybe it's oil and gas or you tech, you pick your vertical and ingest so much data that you have to go crawl the world for basically and put together to say, okay, what does a tech company or an oil and gas company, or you kind of pick your, what does the topology look like of their emissions across buildings and flights and cars and all these things? And it was verticalized. It's still probably, I don't know the latest, but you could have probably, and again, let's just like paint a different picture. I don't know. I guess you could have hired 100 people in 3 weeks or whatever and blown open all of those verticals. You could have. I guess you see what I'm exploring here, right? Like this tension of speed versus thoughtfulness, deliberate kind
delivering
of like
great customer experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. I wish early in the SaaS journey, someone had said, you know what the key to winning a SaaS market is? It's delivering great results for your customers. And there's a lot of complicated stuff that you're going to read all these books and you're going to have people are going to ask you about your moats and all this stuff. And ultimately it's about, do you deliver great results for your customers? Because the beauty of enterprise software is that companies do references, customers talk. There's nothing more magical than having a whole base of delighted customers. And so that was the reason, zooming back to that board meeting where the board gave us a little bit of a wake-up call on moving faster, that was the reason we were being a bit deliberate about trying to really knock it out of the park for every customer. And that is core to our ethos today. The thing we've been trying to figure out is how do you have that be true and meet the scale and urgency of a market that's not unfolding over the course of 20 years, like many software markets do, but it's unfolding over the course of 3 years across every industry and every geography. And that's a hard product strategy problem. It's a hard technology problem. The other thing that's unique about our space is that delivering great outcomes for customers requires depth in climate science data and policy. This is not just about a workflow. Like, there's a lot of enterprise SaaS tools where it's fundamentally about the workflow layer. Watershed is the workflow layer plus a data layer. And the data layer needs to enable Walmart to know the emissions of food suppliers in every food category of food sold on the Walmart shelves. It needs to also enable large financial institutions to know the carbon emissions of every asset in their portfolio. It needs to enable building managers to know the emissions of electricity in Lithuania sourced through a particular utility. And that is this kind of, we think about it as kind of the climate data engine that sits at the core of Watershed. And that's a thing that is really hard to build. That's the thing that we've invested the most energy and technology and science in building over the last 5 years. Part of how we figured out how to go faster was we met an extraordinary entrepreneur named Sangwon Su, who was a climate scientist who literally wrote the textbook on measuring carbon emissions that still generations of practitioners are trained on. He wrote this book 30 years ago, helped to create the GHG protocol, which is kind of the carbon accounting standard for the industry, and then spent 23 years building Vital Metrics, which was the most cross-industry, cross-geo carbon database. And my co-founder Christian met him, and we were just blown away by what he and his team had built. And so Vital Metrics joined Watershed almost exactly a year ago. And that's now the core of our technology in the kind of climate data layer that enables our customers to measure emissions across a whole bunch of different categories and solve the problem you just described. And we're building on top of that. It's now this kind of really neat core of the whole Watershed climate data engine. So that's now enabling us to be in a place today where we can walk into any enterprise in the world and be able to measure their emissions in a science-based, rigorous, actionable way. In fact, if you add up the emissions of all of Watershed's customers today across a whole bunch of different industries, it is 479 million tons of CO2, which is just shy of 1% of the world's carbon emissions. And that speaks to a certain amount of speed and scale that wasn't possible for us 2.5 years ago, but that some of these investments in the data and science have unlocked.
You know who else loves sales besides me? John Doerr.
John Doerr, absolutely.
I get so inspired watching this man, who is not a spring chicken anymore, literally calling the Rolodex at any given moment to fight for his portfolio to win. It's incredible, isn't it?
It's absolutely incredible. John is one of the people I admire most in the world, full stop.
I appreciate you doing this. And I will tell you, and I promise this is the last time that I gas you up, which is this has been one of the most rewarding parts of my job, is working with you and the team and seeing the progress so far in such a short amount of time. It's been amazing. It gives me the warm and fuzzies.
You've been a huge part of it, Jubin. Thank you for helping us along the way.
Are you hiring?
We are hiring a lot of people right now.
Okay.
We are hiring in every role across the US and Europe. That's engineering, people who work with customers, climate science, policy, a lot of sales folks on the front lines of working with big enterprises and getting them to change their business. Yeah, we need a lot of help to pull this thing off.
When you hear the word grit, what do you think of?
I think about the fierceness that is required to do big things. If you're doing something ambitious, you are confronted with a certain sobriety about where you are today, which is generally a lot of things going wrong. You're a kind of broken, half-formed project or company or whatever it is. You have total conviction in where you want to get to. And the bridge between those things is pretty darn intimidating. And to me, grit is the way that you get from here to there, which is to realize there's no straight line you can draw, but somehow you have to kind of force the world to get into shape to make that possible. And there's a perseverance, there's a fierceness, there's a resilience, the grit that can kind of enable you to get from here to there when you're doing something really big and scary.
Taylor Francis, what an answer. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jubin, thank you.
That's it. Thanks for tuning in. Feel free to come back every Monday morning to listen to a new guest or go back into the archives when we've done more than 100 episodes. This podcast is a Kleiner Perkins production, and the episode was edited by Eric Johnson from Lightning Pod. Thank you all.